Why, if God exists, has created us, and loves us, is this just so unclear to so many of us? In the actual world, we all have different access to different information and different capacities with which to assess that information. In other words, the epistemic landscape is incredibly vast. And from where I sit, as best as I can currently judge, it seems to me like there is no such person as God. And my situation is, of course, not an anomaly here. There are entire continents of the so-called epistemic landscape where belief in the existence of such a person is virtually non-existent. And the same can be said about the temporal or geographic landscapes. You might think that this fact, when combined with certain other claims about what a perfect person would do if they existed, constitutes some evidence for thinking that no such person does in fact exist. And according to a number of philosophers, you'd be right about that. Hello and welcome to Real Atheology. Now, broadly speaking, arguments from hiddenness are philosophical arguments with atheistic conclusions arising from the fact that either the felt presence of, the nature of, or the very existence of God is somewhat less clear than we might expect if God, in fact, existed. As with the problem of evil, of course, there's no single argument from hiddenness. Rather, we're talking about a whole family of arguments united by these ideas. The most well-known argument of this sort is, of course, John Schellenberg's argument from divine hiddenness. The literature surrounding his argument in particular is as numerous as it is interesting. However, rather than summarize Schellenberg's argument here, I'm going to use this video to briefly mention other lesser-known variations on hiddenness thinking. Schellenberg's argument, replies to it, and possible modifications to it will be discussed in future videos. Theodore Drange's The Argument from Non-Belief. This is an obvious fit here, right? So in his 1993 article and later in his 1998 book, Drange presents us an argument against what he calls evangelical biblical Christianity. Now, according to Drange's argument, if the God of evangelical biblical Christianity existed, then all or almost all humans since the time of Jesus would come to believe the basics of evangelical biblical Christianity by the time of their death. Now, since, of course, it is not the case that all or almost all humans since the time of Jesus have come to believe in him by the time of their death, then God does not exist. However, a more interesting and, in my view, more formidable challenge within the hiddenness family is found in a 2006 article by Stephen Mason titled Divine Hiddenness and the Demographics of Theism. Here, Mason asks us to attend to how theistic belief is geographically distributed. So when we look out at the world, we notice theistic belief has a much higher concentration in some parts of the world than in others. It's not an even distribution by any means. We observe a kind of lopsidedness. For example, according to a 2018 survey, 94% of the population of Thailand is Buddhist and is therefore not monotheistic. Or consider the native people of the Americas prior to the age of exploration, and the still isolated tribal peoples. Of course, lopsidedness by itself is no surprise here, right? Many cultural beliefs are distributed in just this way. As Mason puts it, messy, uneven data have messy, uneven causes. However, if God exists, belief in God is not just some cultural belief with messy causes, because belief in God is a requirement for a dynamic, explicit relationship with the deepest good possible. Considering possible responses, the lopsidedness is surprising if the primary explanation of unbelief in God is, as many theists assert, moral failure. Are non-theistic cultures uniquely immoral, irrational, or resistant? This explanation seems implausible on its face. More to the point, most of the explanations offered to explain non-belief that identify, say, a good reason that God may have to hide struggle to explain the lopsidedness of theistic belief. Alternative hypotheses see no real mystery here, of course, and so serve as superior explanations of that lopsidedness, and thereby have this evidence in their favor. Now, another interesting hiddenist challenge is presented by Jason and John Marsh in The Explanatory Challenge of Religious Diversity. Throughout human history, humans have believed in a near infinite number of religious concepts, many of which are, of course, incompatible. Now, in response to this religious diversity, a number of arguments have been presented that seek to infer from it a kind of general skepticism about religious beliefs. The thought here is that if the methods we use in acquiring religious beliefs lead us to so many different contradictory conclusions, isn't this a good reason to doubt all such conclusions arrived at by these methods? This seems intuitive. However, there are very good reasons to be very pessimistic about the success of such arguments. In any case, in their 2016 article featured in Advances in Religion, Cognitive Science, and Experimental Philosophy, Jason and John Marsh draw our attention instead to religious diversity and its tension with a particular religious belief. So here's the idea. If some particular theistic religious view is true, and God wants us to know the truth, why is there so much religious diversity? The question poses an explanatory challenge to a particular subset of theists, namely theists who hold that, quote, there is a single, uniquely valuable theistic tradition in the world that by far best approximates the truth about the divine and humanity's place in the world. Now, while this poses a particularly thorny problem for those who think that particular beliefs are necessary for salvation, it also applies to other forms of theistic exclusivism. The argument just highlights a tension between theistic beliefs. The Marshes present the tension at this stage as defeasible, but nevertheless quite serious. However, things get even more interesting in the argument's next step, where they incorporate findings from the cognitive science of religion. Specifically, what they call the naturalness of religion thesis. And here's how they put it. Quote, religious ideas are found throughout all known human cultures, in no small part because humans are naturally predisposed to form and spread beliefs about supernatural agents. Although no one is born with religious beliefs, the basic idea is that with fairly minimal environmental stimuli, instruction, or effort, children in diverse environments tend to come to see the world in terms of some sort of supernatural agency, meaning, and design. Religion, so understood, is thus not merely a product of culture, as many suppose. It is a product of cognition, culture, and whether directly or indirectly, evolution. Now, while there are different frameworks that have been proposed, something like this general statement is seen as correct by most researchers in the field. Not only that, it quite clearly predicts religious diversity as wholly natural, a matter of common course given the known mechanisms of nature. With that in mind, the authors offer the updated challenge by focusing on the origins of that religious diversity. They write, quote, "Whereas the original explanatory challenge asks why God would tolerate or permit so much diversity, the updated challenge asks why God would explicitly design the world to include it." Now, free will or lapsarian strategies appear incapable of providing a plausible explanation here. As Justin Barrett, a Christian himself, observes, quote, "Arguably the oldest and most widespread form of God concepts is the ancestor spirit or ghost, a type of afterlife belief." Now, if that's right, then these limited gods and spirits are a kind of default supernatural content for human cognition. This is the result of how our brains have evolved, guided or unguided. This would be true, of course, even if humankind had never sinned. For this is just what happens when the human brain is functioning properly. Again, the claim is not that God merely permits diversity, rather it is that God, by his design, has caused the diversity to exist by way of the structure of human cognition. It's a surprising design feature if religious exclusivism is true. One could think of the updated challenge as another sort of dysteleological argument. While I mentioned the problem of evil as a distinct problem, there are, of course, areas where blending, or perhaps more appropriate to this next section, bleeding, can occur. To illustrate this, I need to first give a quick summary of William Rowe's famous evidential argument from evil. So here is his 1979 version of the argument. Premise 1. There exist instances of intense suffering which an omnipotent, omniscient being could have prevented without thereby losing some greater good or permitting some evil equally bad or worse. This is called the factual premise. Now, premise 2 states, an omniscient, wholly good being would prevent the occurrence of any intense suffering it could, unless it could not do so without thereby losing some greater good or permitting some evil equally bad or worse. And that second premise is known as the theological premise. The conclusion, then, is that there does not exist an omnipotent, omniscient, wholly good being. Now, in support of the factual premise, Rowe identifies instances of intense suffering that appear to fit the description laid out. First, his famous fawn. Rowe talks of a fawn who, as a result of a natural forest fire, suffers burns and lays in agony for days before ultimately giving in to his injuries. Second, you can use your imagination to think of an instance of unspeakable moral evil, the kind that just churns your stomach, say the prolonged neglect and active multifaceted abuse and isolation of a child for over a decade. That these things happen, of course, is not a matter of dispute, and yet it appears to us that no good that we know of connects to either that fawn's suffering or the suffering of the child in such a way as it could justify an omnipotent, omniscient being in permitting it. Rowe then infers from our ignorance of any goods that could justify such a being in allowing those evils, to the claim that no good at all could justify an omnipotent, omniscient being in permitting those particular evils. Now, this inference from inscrutable evils to gratuitous evils appears to rely on the assumption that if there are goods capable of justifying God in allowing those evils, we would be cognizant of those goods. However, skeptical theists have earned their label with their outright denial of such an assumption. Now, they argue that the epistemic gap that exists between God and man is just too great for any confidence of that sort. In doing so, they employ various analogies designed to emphasize this epistemic gap. According to one, we are like children whose confusion at their parents permitting their suffering stems from their ignorance of the many ways in which parents may justifiably allow their children to experience suffering. However, with that move, we can then return hiddenness arguments to the center of the stage. After all, as Rowe illustrates, our inability to know the specific goods that can justify a God in permitting the evils we experience isn't the only thing that the parent-child analogy has to offer for our consideration. Quote, "We know that when a good, loving parent permits her child to suffer severely for some future outweighing good that the child cannot understand, the loving parent then makes every effort to be consciously present to the child during his period of suffering, giving special assurances of her love, concern, and care." And so on the basis of the good parent analogy, we should infer that it is likely that God, too, will almost always be consciously present to humans, if not other animals, when he permits them to suffer for goods they cannot comprehend, giving special assurances of his love for them. So here's the rub. The skeptical theists claim that Rowe's sufferers should not expect to know the specific reasons why God allows their suffering is one thing, right? However, to claim that we should not expect to know that there are any such reasons is quite another. The second claim is not even touched on by most forms of skeptical theism. Now recall that Rowe's theological premise assumes that if God exists, then there is no gratuitous evil. But if that's correct, then one who believes in God should also believe that there is no gratuitous evil. Confident theists, then, will go through life experiencing evils which they will admit seem gratuitous at the time, but insofar as they believe in God, must ultimately conclude that they are not, in fact, gratuitous. Those theists who directly suffer from evils will have their suffering reduced by their belief in God's having good reasons for permitting it. In the same way, children who suffer pain that their parent permits suffer less when in possession of the belief that their parent exists, is loving, and wants the best for them. Returning to the issue of God, those of us who do not have belief in God have no such inference available. We're left with the appearance of evils in our world, and the appearance that there is no God in possession of good reasons to permit those evils. Again, this is quite separate from the complaint that we fail to see goods that could potentially permit God to allow them, right? Put simply, God's hiddenness exacerbates Rowe's problem of evil. The intellectual ignorance, doubt, or confusion of whether there are, in fact, good reasons for the sufferings we experience is not, of course, the only way that our sufferings are made worse by God's hiddenness. To illustrate, suppose you take your young child to a clinic for a medically necessary yet painful shot. Assuming you love your child and genuinely care for their well-being, we'd expect you to at least try to ease the anguish and terror that exacerbates the associated suffering by, as best as you know how, being an explicit comforting presence for them. This is important, for the increased suffering that anguish and terror add to their physical pain can be defeated by the comforting presence of parental love. There are several ways this could work in the human example, right? So speaking to them in a familiar, calming voice, maintaining physical and or visual contact, even using like silly faces to elicit laughter as a way to help them relax and pull attention away from the moment, thereby lessening the sting of the needle's jab. A parent who shows no sensitivity at all to their child's terror during such a moment would seem to most as a less than loving parent. Eric Wielenberg notes that theists report experiencing moments of deep anguish just as much as their non-theistic brothers and sisters. Theists who believe their sufferings are justified by God-permitting reasons must often still contend with the additional fact that they do not feel God's comforting presence in their darkest hour. God appears silent or absent to them in the moment they need him most. They are like our terrified and confused child, perceiving the painful shot as their parent is nowhere to be seen. Prima facie, this appears surprising on the assumption that a loving God exists. And this can feel especially odd if these theists regularly report feeling his explicit presence in their best moments, or in their quiet, contemplative, and prayerful moments. Of course, for the non-theist, every moment of suffering is associated with a lack of God's comforting presence. The point here is just that theists also often report a lack of God's comforting presence in their darkest hour, and this frequently spells the end of one's faith. In response to worries of this sort, though, some recognize the weight of the issue, but instead view it as a mere emotional problem. There's this distinction between the emotional problem of evil on the one hand and the intellectual problem of evil on the other. We're then assured that problems of the sort just mentioned fall into the latter category, and therefore, while they might require sensitive and appropriately applied pastoral care, they require little else. Wrestling intellectually just isn't necessary here when dealing with emotional problems. Now, interestingly, strategies of pastoral care often recognize the value of being present with persons in their moment of anguish and encourage employing such strategies as being a calming, close presence to them. In a way, then, some pastoral care just is filling in for a silent and distant God. In light of the fact that many do not feel God's presence in their time of need, the emotional problem of evil must also be recognized as a serious intellectual problem belonging to the broad divine hiddenness family. Music is by Casserole and used with permission. Now, if you like the content and the tone of what Real Eight Theology has to offer, please leave a review on iTunes. You can support us directly by making a small recurring donation to our Patreon. Comments, questions, criticisms, or requests can be sent in audio form to realatheology@gmail.com for possible inclusion in future episodes. We want to give a special thanks to our newest patron, Charles Hoffer, as well as Tyler Bimrose, Jason, Robin Willems, Ed Atkinson, Kim Bishkovsky, Anthony Lawson, Jeff Rubinoff, and Brandon McCleary.